Next case we have is a Dion Blackwell versus the Commonwealth of Virginia. It's Mr. Wisely for the appellant and Ms. Tyson for the Commonwealth. And did you folks get the chance to sign in?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Your Honor?
Certainly, yes. And Mr. Wisely, would you like to reserve some time, sir?
No, I'd like to reserve 7 minutes.
7 minutes? Sure.
Thank you.
Your Honor, may it please the court, I'm Eric Wisely for Dion Blackwell.
Mr. Wisely, may I ask you a question at the beginning just to try to narrow the playing field a little?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do I understand correctly from page one of your reply brief that appellant is not contesting the admissibility of the STET docket information just the way the Commonwealth used it?
That's accurate, Your Honor. The statute 19.2-299 is clear that it the one little distinction between 19.2-299 and 19.2-295.1, which controls for a jury, is criminal history versus history of conviction. If you look at the Thomas case, he actually challenged the admissibility of the PSR, or the pre-sentence investigation report, because it contained cases that were null prost. We didn't contest the PSR admission or even having that be a part of the PSR. What we challenged, Your Honor, is the Commonwealth argued that STET docket information somehow proved that my client had prior dealings with drugs, and it's a completely inadmissible use of that information. So, yes, that's accurate, Your Honor. We don't challenge the...
Okay, so admissibility is not the issue if it's the manner that the Commonwealth is attempting to use it. I'm just trying to understand completely.
Well, it's a good question. The case law is clear that the reason this sort of information can come before a judge and should not ever come before a jury, and that's sort of the dichotomy between Thomas and the Byrd case.
Well, let me just this is page one on your reply brief, the second, well, arguably the third full paragraph after the heading. I quote, the appellant does not argue that the, quote, trial court erroneously admitted the STET docket information in the pre-sentence report. Is that correct? You're not
That's
arguing
correct.
That it should not have been admissible?
That's correct, because the Byrd case, the difference between Byrd and Thomas, Byrd was a jury case, Thomas was a bench trial case. It was a plea agreement. But the difference is that a trial court judges ascribe the ability to make these determinations as to what part of evidence is admissible, what it's to be used for. And in this case, it's sort of like the trial court is given or ascribed by the appellate courts to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff. This trial court didn't know what chaff was and said so explicitly. It said it did not have any idea what the STET docket was, and the Commonwealth offered it no evidence as to what the STET docket was. And I have to confess, at the time, I had a little bit of a misunderstanding as to what the STET docket was. Commonwealth offered no evidence as to what that was. So there's some evidence, or there's sort of a pedantic brief, I guess, in the Commonwealth's brief about what the STET docket is. That's not fair. The Commonwealth had no idea what the trial court had no idea what the STET docket means, what it meant at the time. And so in that, it was very much like a jury. It did not know what a STET docket was. And if you look at the language that's employed in the Byrd case, it was a jury case, but there's three parts to the Byrd analysis. It starts with whether the null pros is properly contained, or if it's explicitly allowed by 19.2-295.1. And it answered that question, no, it's not expressly allowed. So then it moved on to a relevancy analysis. And in that case, it said, here, in the Byrd case, evidence of null pros charges could be misunderstood by a jury and misapplied because no explanation of the meaning of the term was given to the jury. And if you go down, it says, it also talks about, in addition, because the court allowed consideration of the charges, the evidence could also be erroneously treated by the jury as proof that the accused was involved in the perpetration of other crimes. This trial court was in the same position as the Byrd jury. It had no evidence. Admittedly, it said it did not know what the stat docket was.
There's a marked difference between 295 and 299, right, in terms of what a jury can consider and what a judge can consider.
Yes, Your Honor.
And pre-sentence reports contain all sorts of information, such as other charges with no disposition.
Age, weight, race, religion.
The fact that somebody in seventh grade was suspended from school.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what is the significance of the fact that there were charges with a stat docket, which could mean anything, and that the judge considered it? What is the difference between that and just considering a charge with no disposition?
Well, Your Honor, PSR is allowed to have the age, weight, religion, race of the defendant in there, but if the trial court tried to use any of that information to elevate a crime, to elevate the punishment, it just wouldn't pass any. I mean, it wouldn't pass the laugh test. So the fact that there is a criminal history, whether the stat docket is in the PSR, is not the problem. The problem is how it's used. And explicitly, we have a problem because the trial court said almost nothing. It said it embraced wholeheartedly the arguments of the Commonwealth and the evidence of the Commonwealth.
The pre-sentence report itself is evidence in sentencing, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But that doesn't mean that you can use every piece of information that's in a PSR to elevate it, to depart upward. I mean, this is almost four times the high end of the guidelines. And the reason, and to get back to Judge O'Brien's question, she asks, what does it matter? So there's stat docket information. Well, the Commonwealth said specifically, the reason it wanted that stat docket information there is because, for two reasons. It shows, number one, that he had past dealings with drugs. That's an impermissible use of that information, and that is the holding in Byrd. It also said that Maryland doesn't take drugs seriously. That was the other reason that it used the stat docket, which is also impermissible because, moving on to the second assignment of error, this is a geographical bias issue that's completely separate from the stat docket issue. I mean, that is an evidentiary, but this is a constitutional issue. You cannot send a message to an outside community. You just can't do that. You can't punish my client for everything that the trial court or every person that it couldn't get a hold of, every crime that had ever been committed, every Baltimore heroin that had come into Warren County. My client can't be punished for that. There are permissible ways to make those arguments. This was not one of those. So
The judge, as part of its sentencing obligation, can always consider deterrence in making a sentencing determination.
Yes, it can, Your Honor. But if you look at the Diamond case, and if you look at the Byrd case, the Diamond case that I cited in the reply brief, you can't say, by you, the trial court cannot say, we're going to send a message back to Baltimore or any location. We're going to send a message back to them. That is something that cannot be done. That's the Fourth Circuit case of Diamond. It's binding on this court. At least the reasoning is. But there's also a concession here, Your Honor. The Commonwealth has made the concession. I think it's a correct one. It's actually kind of beautiful in its reasoning. I hope the court includes it in its opinion. I quote, it is error for a prosecutor to ask a jury to send a message to an outside community.
Well, sure, that's to a jury.
It is. So why then what the Commonwealth can't do is give any authority for the proposition that what it is error to ask a jury, it is okay to ask for and receive from a judge. Because that's what happened here. So
you're into your rebuttal, but
what we do have is Diamond. Diamond stands for that proposition.
And the answer to that question may be, I'm not suggesting that it is, the answer to that question may be is that a judge has more tools in his or her toolbox than a jury. A judge has in his or her toolbox the ability to grant probation. Jury can't do that. Obviously, a judge by law cannot enhance a jury verdict. Okay, but we do have sentencing guidelines which give guidelines for judges to provide appropriate sentences.
Look at the Thomas case. Thomas is a judge sentence. If you look at the Thomas case, Thomas went the other way. But in Thomas, the trial court specifically said, and this is the reason Thomas went the way it did. Thomas, he did object to the PSR, so he's essentially saying that the statute won't stand in Thomas. That's not the way I would argue it, and I haven't. The issue is that information can't be used this way. He said, the trial court said, look, I'm not using it that way. I'm not using it the way that would be objectionable. And this court held, that's why it's okay. Because a judge can do that. A judge can say, I'm entitled to that information. The statute provides that I'm going to get that information. It's part of the criminal history. I can see that information, but I'm not going to use it in the improper way. And because it said that, and that is the holding in Thomas, because the court said that in Thomas, that's why the trial court was affirmed.
But judges are not monolithic. You may have one judge. Well, you kind of made a face when I said that. I don't think you look up here, you see three judges that look and act the same. But in any event, judges are not monolithic. And so therefore, a judge who, say, maybe served for 20 years in the military could have a military individual come before him or her in sentencing. And because that judge has a history with the military, is proud of the uniform, and thinks that what this individual did was an embarrassment to the uniform, might sentence that person different than the way I may sentence because my military career was very short. Is there anything wrong with that?
There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, Your Honor. If he says so, this court embraced wholeheartedly every single argument made by the Commonwealth and said nothing else. It said, I find the Commonwealth's arguments are well-founded. That's not what the judge did in Thomas. The judge in Thomas said, look, I know what this information's for. I know how to use it. I'm a judge. This is what I did. I'm not accepting this for any impermissible purpose. That's not what the trial court did here. The trial court here accepted arguments. Let's send a message back to Baltimore. Seven times he said, let's send a message back to Baltimore. Send a message back to Baltimore. Eight times if you count when it said, want him to go back to Baltimore and tell him what you did. Eight different times he said that. Eight times he referred to Baltimore. Four times he referred to Maryland. He used that information because, and unfortunately he didn't say this is why he used it, but the Commonwealth asked him to use this information. Don't impose 5 years. Don't suspend any time. Don't put him in CCAT. Don't do anything else. The trial court did exactly what the Commonwealth said. Exactly what the Commonwealth said. And the reason the Commonwealth laid out, all the reasons the Commonwealth laid out, but in particular, the Stett docket as being part of it, the fact that he's from Maryland, the fact that he's from Baltimore, all of these reasons, they're impermissible. They're not to be used that way.
Well, I'm going to ask a question in your rebuttal time that I want you to think about. We've had, over the course of this particular panel, several cases, one case saying that the judge said too much, another case saying the judge didn't say enough. Where is the bright line?
Well, I don't think I could draw that bright line. I know that circuit court judges are probably very cognizant of the fact that you'll be looking over their shoulder at some point, but I don't think what we should send a message to them is let's say nothing, and then we'll just pick out the best reason. He made maybe one or two permissible arguments in this case, and the rest, as I said, eight times, send a message to Baltimore. Maryland doesn't take drug cases seriously because of the Stett docket, which shouldn't even be considered for any purpose. It can be in the PSR, but if he had used my client's race or my client's religion or my client's age or my client's weight against him in order to elevate this to 3.5 times the high end of the guidelines, it's court blanche.
That would be an equal protection claim. Is there an equal protection claim here?
I'm not making an equal potential claim. What I'm saying is when you have a geographical bias in a case, sometimes those effects are racial, sometimes those effects are socioeconomic. I've known both the judge and the Commonwealth attorney in this case for many years. Neither one harbors any bias. But when you have a geographical bias, those effects can sometimes cross boundaries, and that's what happened here. I'm going to try and reserve the last minute and a half, it looks like. Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure. Ms. Tice.
Good morning. May it please the court, I feel like I want to have a little trailer here. Put my things down. I would like to begin, because I don't want my time to get away from me, to say that I believe my opponent has overstated the concession that we had in our brief. What we argued under Hutchins and Jackson with regard to sending a message to the community is that it is improper for a prosecutor to argue to a jury when the jury is considering guilt and innocence and punishment that we need to send a message back to a community. What Hutchins said and this court echoed in Jackson was that it is permissible, even with a jury, even considering the prosecutor's argument, to argue for a particular sentence to deter
this conduct in the future, deter others from committing this crime. And I would argue that in this case, that is why there is not error.
That's jury deterrence.
That was a jury. Yes, sir.
Not judge deterrence.
And of course, to deter another from committing that crime. Yes, sir.
It's like the thing that we always teach in law school. You can't say to a jury, we've got to send this person away for a long time because it could be you next time.
Right.
Those types of things.
There certainly are things, Your Honor, yes, excuse me, that we cannot say to a jury. I want to talk very briefly about this debt docket. I do want to point out that the assignment of error in this case, number one, with regard to the debt docket, was that the trial court erred when it admitted evidence in sentencing of prior charges in Maryland for which appellant had not been convicted. So I believe there's been a morphing of the argument from the assignment of error, because that is the assignment of error that this court granted. And it was not error to admit the debt docket, and it was not error in the way that it was used at this trial. I think the most important thing I can say with regard to this is that Byrd and Smith are completely inapposite to our issue, because we aren't talking about the penalty phase of a jury trial. We're not talking about Code Section 19.2-295.1. We're talking about the sentencing hearing. This case was resolved on a guilty plea, a non-Alford guilty plea. And every issue in this case arises from the actual sentencing hearing, where the judge, who has before him the pre-sentence report, which 19.2-299 says, this is the tool we're going to give judges.
Am I missing something? But the step docket wasn't offered in and of itself. The step docket was offered, excuse me, as part of the PSI.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. It's on that page 10A, 10B, where charges which had been null prost were also listed there. This court can, as we argued on brief, take judicial notice about what this debt docket is. There are cases that have not been prosecuted to completion. They can be brought back.
They're include still pending charges.
They can be, Your Honor. And of course, we included the rule in the brief. It's published. It's out there. If someone at trial had wanted to find it, certainly they could. We were able to find it very quickly. The Thomas case, which is probably the epitome of the cases and on which Wolf relied from this court, says that a trial court in sentencing can consider a laundry list of things, which includes prior juvenile adjudications, dismissed juvenile charges, and pending charges for which the accused has been indicted but not convicted, evidence of unadjudicated criminal activity. That's the holding from this court. This is an on-bank decision in Thomas that then Wolf relied upon. And so the fact that there are listed in the pre-sentence report these charges for which there's not a disposition is not error, and it's not error for the court to rely on them, and it's not error for the Commonwealth to say, look at 19.2-299C. Which says that a pre-sentence report shall, in a felony drug case, include evidence of associations of illicit drug markets and operations. Those are words we don't often see in statutes, but certainly all of the charges on the stat docket did involve drug offenses, either possession, conspiracy, or distribution.
And trial judges have that kind of information all the time when they make determinations in cases where a person has had something similar to a 251 disposition in another jurisdiction. You get something akin to a 251 disposition in Maryland, and then the lawyer in Virginia comes down on a new drug charge and says, I want a 251 disposition, and the court always says, I think from looking at this docket, you've already had the benefit of that, so I'm going to exercise my discretion and not give you that consideration.
Yes, sir. That would be a very similar situation to what we have here. So it's our position that there was no error in admitting the evidence. There was no error in relying upon it. And with regard to the second assignment of error, in which the defendant argued that a denial of a suspended sentence and upward departure were inappropriate. And the argument on brief from the defendant in this particular assignment of error was that the upward departure in this case, I am reading from page 13 of his opening brief, can only reasonably be understood as elevating appellant's sentence, at least in part one, for the conduct of other people who lived in or got heroin from Baltimore, or else two, because appellant was an urbanite African-American. That's his argument on brief. And today, again, I think the argument is a little different than what was on brief. I will say, first of all...
That argument there suggests some sort of equal protection situation.
It also suggests that there is some sort of racial motivation, at least with regard to number two. And I think initially with regard to this argument, as we argued on brief, if those kinds of accusations, if you will, are going to be made for a member of the bar or a member of the bench, those arguments need to be made at trial. And certainly the argument with regard to an urbanite African-American was not made at trial. The closest that the defense came at trial was to argue, and this is on page 68 of the appendix, is I certainly hope that Baltimore or Maryland is not a euphemism for something else. But this express argument that was raised on brief was not presented to the trial judge or to
What was the trial judge's response when that suggestion was made? And I think anybody reasonably can read into what counsel said what he meant there, that this is not for some other reason.
Well, Your Honor, there really was not a response. Really was not a response from the judge. The prosecutor came back and said, and I believe there was a misuse of the word euphemism. We pointed that out in our brief. And the prosecutor said that Baltimore doesn't treat drug cases seriously enough. And so if the word euphemism is used there, that was the response from the prosecution. But I will tell this court, and it's very obvious in the record here, that the trial court wrote down its reason, as it must, for its upward departure from the sentencing guidelines. And that reason was heroin epidemic. And I think it's very important that the evidence before this sentencing judge was that they had had twice as many overdoses from heroin this year as they had had from this time last year. And that the amount of heroin that this particular defendant had brought into Baltimore and pled guilty to the fact that he brought into Baltimore and did that bringing for $840 was enough heroin for 60 to 120 doses of the drug. In fact, the prosecutor argued it 60 to 120 clicks of the trigger because people are dying from the use of the heroin. That was argued
within Warren County.
In Warren County, yes, sir. And that's part of the argument that the trial judge was considering. That is the argument that the Commonwealth made with regard to why it is that the judge should sentence to 5 years and not probation. 5 years, which, as we noted on brief, is the minimum sentence that the legislature has put in the statute. Of course, the trial judge can suspend that, has the power to suspend that. But 5 years is the minimum sentence that the legislature has fixed for the crime of distribution of this schedule of narcotic. And I would also like to point out one other thing about the departure. Of course, under 1922.98.01F, merely a departure from the guidelines is not a basis for appellate relief or relief in any other post-conviction proceeding. And so to say the judge deviated from the guidelines, that's not a viable claim. There has to be something that is very inappropriate. And with regard to whether the trial judge accepted everything that the prosecutor had argued to him, I think it's important to note, and I agree with my opposing counsel that the judge did not say a lot on the record. But at the time that the judge indicated that the Commonwealth's position was well-founded, there had just been allocution, and the defendant had talked about his position and why he had done what he did. And the trial judge, on page 76 of the appendix, notes, "I have heard you, and I appreciate the things that you are saying. But I find the position of the Commonwealth has been well-founded. I sentence you to 5 years in prison." Well, the Commonwealth's position was this defendant had brought in enough heroin for 60 to 120 uses of that drug. This defendant had brought heroin into our county because he was paid $840 to do it. the judge had before him the evidence that 90% of the heroin that came into Warren County came from Baltimore. There's no question that that evidence was before the trial judge, and that the prosecutor wanted to send to deter others. You send a message, if you want to say send a message of deterrence for others to not commit this crime. And so the trial judge has put on the record that the reason he departed was because of the heroin epidemic. And the record supports that indication, that recitation, if you will, on the sentencing guideline sheet. And so the trial judge did not err in departing from the guidelines and did not rely on some sort of constitutional impermissible reason for sentencing this person to a prison sentence and not suspending that time. And so now we look over at the third assignment of error, which is that the trial court impermissibly refused to let this defendant onto the CCAT program or another alternative program. And I would say that I probably should distinguish this Diamond case on which the defendant relied in his reply brief, which was a federal case from the Eastern District of Virginia, as the judge who had imposed a sentence, a greater sentence, from someone who came from New York down to Virginia. I do think it's important. The case is from 1977. It is the Fourth Circuit, and certainly is persuasive but not binding on this court. But I think what's probably the distinguishing factor here is that we cannot permit a district judge who is an officer of a national judicial system and who is enforcing a national criminal code to be moved by such considerations of parochialism in imposing sentences. And if you read this case, you'll see that the judge, when he sentenced the person, said this is probably going up on appeal or this is an appellate issue or what have you. That's not the situation we have here. The situation we have here is that 90% of the heroin that was coming into this county was coming from Baltimore, and this particular person brought in a great deal of that heroin. I don't think constitutional issues were preserved at trial, as we argued on brief with regard to this. And I actually, the case that was cited by defense counsel, Toomer versus Witzel, also points out that when you're looking at a constitutional issue such as privileges and immunities or equal protection, that those are not absolute. That was the shrimp boat case. That there's not discrimination among people from other states is not permitted, except the clause bars discrimination against citizens of other states where there is no substantial reason for it. And the reason here is that this particular defendant was bringing in the illegal narcotics into Warren County. I think probably one of the most important things I can say about this assignment of error, however, is that there hasn't been any showing that someone who was not from Baltimore would have been placed on this probation or given some alternate disposition. And counsel argues in reply that he had no burden to produce this evidence. But I suggest what he hasn't done on appeal is shown the prejudice. He hasn't shown that he was prejudiced. He hasn't shown that this trial judge, given the facts of the amount of the heroin and the problem in the county, would not have sentenced anyone, even someone who'd lived in Warren County his whole life, that the trial judge would have given that person probation or another alternate program.
Sometimes people conflate the duty of a defense attorney in the context of trial, where traditionally and appropriately he or she has is given the prerogative of presenting no evidence, as opposed to sentencing. When I was a defense attorney, I always felt that was my obligation to provide evidence to support sentencing alternatives. So.
And yes, and certainly there was evidence brought before the court with regard to these programs, but the trial judge said that he was sentencing the way he did because of the heroin epidemic. I think we take the trial judge at his word in that regard. He may not have said much, but he did write that down on the sentencing guideline sheet. This trial court did not err in any of the respects that have been brought before the court today, and thus we would urge this court to affirm the judgment of the Warren County Court.
Thank you. Ms. Tyson.
Let's start with counsel's argument on prejudice, which dovetails with Diamond in a strange way.
If you look at Diamond, they couldn't cite the case. They couldn't cite the law. They couldn't cite the fact that it was a privileges and immunity issue that they were finding in Diamond. Diamond said essentially what I'm saying now and couldn't produce law either. Yet they did apply the doctrine of automatic reversal. If you note, they didn't look for harmless error. They didn't look for prejudice. They saw the error. They reversed it. That denotes to me that this is a constitutional issue. I think it's a constitutional issue that's so obvious to the Diamond Court, and I think to counsel and her concession, that it was automatically reversed. They didn't look for anything new, anything else to hang their hat on. The prejudice was irrelevant to that part of the analysis. The one final thing that I'm going to talk about is she says that the deterrence. Deterrence is the reason. Well, the best argument I have for that is the words of the trial court Commonwealth attorney who said, quite frankly, it's more about sending a message. And this is on transcript or appendix, page 70. Once again, he's the first in this court that we have been able to prosecute successfully from Maryland who brought heroin here. It's more about sending a message. He needs, further down, he needs to be severely punished and to send a message back to Baltimore. That's what they were trying to do. They successfully did it. They can't do it. It needs to be remanded to the trial court. The trial court should resentence. Not resentence. The sentence is imposed. They need to consider alternatives to incarceration. They need to consider all the things that they simply did not exercise their discretion to do the first time around. And that is our argument. Thank you.
Thank you. Folks, we will come down and shake hands.